progressive. Everybody knows Danny Glover's movies. What many do not know is that Danny is a lifelong activist who has been involved in the struggle for racial, economic, and social justice for decades. Danny was very involved in the campaign and spoke at some of our larger rallies. He brought my old friend and fellow mayor, Gus Newport, to one of them, and we all had an excellent discussion over dinner, a rare opportunity in fast-paced days. Mark Ruffalo is not only the Hulk, he is also a strong environmentalist. We got together in Brooklyn to have an unscripted, in-depth discussion about environmental issues, with cameras just capturing it all. Millions saw it via social media. Shailene Woodley is a young actress actively involved in the environmental movement and the fight for Native American rights. Her voice was loud and clear throughout our campaign. I have known Vermont's own Ben Cohn and Jerry Greenfield, Ben and Jerry, for decades. Not only did they create an outstanding ice cream and become leaders in the business for social responsibility movement, they are heavily involved in the fight for campaign finance reform and other progressive causes. Both of them campaigned for and with me throughout the country. Jane had seen Dick Van Dyke, the TV and movie star, in an interview talking about how the United States was moving toward an oligarchic society. He sounded like our kind of guy. He came aboard the campaign, did a number of events with me, and at 90 was incredibly spry. Killer Mike, the rapper, is a brilliant artist who helped us reach out to young people, black, white, and Latino, throughout the country in a way that I could not have without him. He introduced me to a large audience in his hometown of Atlanta, Georgia, and worked hard for us in numerous venues throughout the country. Jim Hightower is somebody I've known for decades. He is a former Texas Commissioner of Agriculture, a best-selling author, and one of the great political humorists in the country. In Texas and throughout America, Jim played an active role in the campaign. Actress Mimi Kennedy came on board very early, delivering petitions to have me run for president even before I announced. She generously hosted one of our very few fundraisers in the backyard of her home in California. Seth MacFarlane, an actor and producer, was also one of the first to come on board and provided a big boost with the young generation. Francis Fisher, George Lopez, Stephen Bishop, Justin Long, Josh Fox, Kendrick Sampson, and Tim Robbins all came on early and stayed active as well. They spoke at rallies, came up with innovative ways to reach out to their audiences, and made a significant difference in the campaign. These are just a few of the men and women, actors, actresses, singers, dancers, rappers, artists, who played an active role in my campaign. These well-known Americans were willing, sometimes against a great deal of peer pressure, to stick their necks out for the political revolution. I am grateful for what they did and look forward to working with them in the future. Fighting for organizational support. From day one of the campaign, we knew that it was important to win the backing of progressive organizations with large memberships. Despite the fact that I was one of the most progressive members of Congress, with a far stronger record than Secretary Clinton, that turned out to be a difficult task. Hillary and Bill Clinton had developed close personal ties with many of the leaders of these organizations over the years, and the Clinton campaign was able to win many of them over. During the fight for endorsements, I noticed an interesting process. In those organizations that held open and democratic grassroots elections regarding the endorsement process, we usually did very well. In those organizations where endorsements were determined by executive boards, we usually lost. In general, we did well with the rank and file, not so well with the inside the beltway leadership. We knew our campaign was taking off when we won the strong support of Democracy for America and MoveOn.org. These are two of the largest online grassroots organizations in the country. They both have millions of members. These two organizations opened up the endorsement process to their members, and in both cases, we won landslide victories, over 70% of the vote. Both groups played an aggressive and positive role in the campaign. We also won the support of some great national unions. The National Nurses United, led by the dynamic Roseanne DeMauro, was the first national union to support us. They joined not just because they are a progressive union, but because of my support for Medicare for All single-payer health care program. These nurses, who take their life-saving jobs very seriously, understood that they were unable to fully do the jobs they were trained to do within a dysfunctional healthcare system that denied care to millions. They wanted real healthcare reform, they wanted Bernie Sanders for president, and they played an active role in many, many states. The Communications Workers of America, CWA, led by Chris Shelton, also came on board early. They knew my record well and knew that in my 25 years in Congress, I had one of the strongest pro-union voting records of any member. They also knew that over the years, I had worked with them on a number of telecommunications issues. In fact, on more than one occasion, I had walked the picket lines with CWA members in Vermont and elsewhere. I have been one of the strongest supporters in Congress of the United States Postal Service and have worked with the postal unions for years against Republican efforts to privatize it. In fact, a couple of years ago, a few of us in the Senate managed to prevent the shutdown of thousands of rural post offices. I was honored to have been invited to speak to the American Postal Workers Union, led by Mark Dimenstein. The support I received at their meeting in Las Vegas was strong, and I was proud to receive their endorsement soon after. Our infrastructure, our roads, bridges, rail, public transit, water systems, and wastewater plants, they are crumbling. And nobody knows that better than the workers who are employed in those systems and their unions. One of the most important parts of my agenda was creating millions of new jobs by rebuilding our infrastructure. I was the leader of two of the major transportation unions in the country, the Amalgamated Transit Union and the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, came on board the campaign in support of that agenda. As we fought to get union support, Larry Cohn, the former president of the CWA, did an incredible job in organizing grassroots support for a Labor for Bernie coalition. Hillary Clinton had the support of a number of union leaders. We were getting the support of the rank and file. On several occasions, I was on a telephone conference call with thousands of grassroots trade union activists. In the spring, we won an important victory by getting the national AFL-CIO to postpone their endorsement. Despite the fact that it was assumed by almost everyone that the AFL-CIO, representing 12.5 million workers, would endorse Secretary Clinton early on, our backers on the executive committee were able to win a postponement until after the nominating process was completed. This was important because it meant that the significant resources of the national AFL-CIO, in terms of money and volunteer efforts, would not be utilized to benefit the Clinton campaign. Paid media. In my Vermont campaigns, we almost always did paid media, television, radio, and print, close to home. We relied on local media people we had known for years. The exception to that was in 1996, when I anticipated a rough re-election campaign to the U.S. Congress. In 1994, during the Gingrich Republican landslide, I had run the worst campaign of my life and won by only 2 points. We knew we would have trouble in 1996, and we needed expertise that we didn't have in Vermont. Tad Devine was recommended to me by Congressman Peter DeFazio, a friend of mine. Devine was a nationally known Democratic media consultant and had done great work for candidates all across the country. He did our media work in 1996 and returned to Vermont in 2006 to help us with my U.S. Senate campaign. Tad is actually the only national political media person I know. I had used him on two occasions in Vermont, so it was only natural that I turned to him again for the presidential race. He brought with him a number of other people from his firm, including Mark Longabaugh, Julian Mulvey, and Scott Turner, who were also extremely helpful. Mark, a strong environmentalist, not only helped us do general political work, but played an important role in reaching out for us to the environmental community. While we put an enormous amount of resources and energy into rallies, social media, and grassroots organizing, there is no question that paid media and television advertising played an important role in the campaign and that we put a lot of money into that effort. Political experts can argue about how important TV and radio campaign ads are in the changing media world in which we live. But no one denies that large parts of our population, for better or worse, continue to receive much of the information about the world in which they live from television. Media ads remain very important, and, as much as I would have liked to, they were a political tool that we could not ignore. I'm proud of the quality of the ads that we ran. Some of them were pointed, but they weren't negative. We never once mentioned the name of Hillary Clinton in any paid media that we did. Don't take my word for it, but many objective observers commented that some of our ads were the best produced of the entire campaign. One beautiful ad that received a lot of national attention was called America, which included the music to the Simon & Garfunkel song of that title. Over lunch in the Capitol many months before, Jane and I had talked to Paul Simon about allowing us to use one of his songs. He agreed. Art Garfunkel also came on board, and the ad was produced. Brent Brodowski of the Washington paper The Hill wrote, "The new television ad that was released by the Senator Bernie Sanders campaign, based on Simon & Garfunkel's song America, is the most brilliant and appropriate campaign ad of the year so far, and may be the most important campaign ad since President Reagan's Morning in America ad. The ad perfectly captures the vision and spirit of the Sanders campaign and the mood of an America today that is the stuff of diverse people yearning to come together for common dreams and aspirations at a time when many voters are hurting and hungering for a better life. The ad brings together music and video behind the Sanders message in a way that is fun to watch and memorable in substance and tone." Fundraising. The message is key to any serious campaign, but the message doesn't matter much if nobody hears it. There are 50 states in our country, and we would eventually need staff for all of them if we were going to win primaries and caucuses. Rallies are great, but you have to pay for the venues that you use, and there are sound systems, lighting, security, and other rally costs. There are many, many people who want to volunteer in a campaign, but to effectively mobilize them, paid coordinators are needed. Television and radio ads may be old-fashioned, but they remain vital to a modern campaign. Somebody was going to have to produce the ads and put them on the air, an expensive proposition. Social media is an exploding medium, but the people who produce it need a paycheck. How could we pay for all of this? Well, we were going to have to raise a lot of money. When I ran for governor in 1986 and lost, I was outspent. When I ran for Congress in 1988 and lost, I was outspent. When I ran for Congress again in 1990 and won, I was outspent. In 2006, when I was elected as Vermont senator, I was outspent. Raising money is the ugliest part of modern American politics, and I personally hate to do it. As a result of Citizens United, a bad fundraising process became much worse. Nowadays, a serious run for the presidency requires somewhere around $1 billion. As I've said many times, I am going to do everything I can to bring about real campaign finance reform, overturn Citizens United, and move to public funding of elections. But that wasn't going to happen in this campaign. We needed money now. We would have to do some serious fundraising. Over the years, the easiest, the most effective way for me to raise money was to take an old-fashioned approach. I would write long letters to my list of supporters, analyzing the current situation and describing to them what I hoped to accomplish. We printed up the letters by the tens of thousands, took them to the post office, mailed them, and waited for the return envelopes to come back. In more recent years, we also used email and the internet to raise funds, and that also worked well, bringing in large numbers of small contributions. All in all, when I was running in Vermont, we were able to raise a reasonable sum of money for a statewide race from small individual contributors. In addition, we received help from labor unions, environmental groups, senior groups, and many other organizations sympathetic to my politics. Sometimes, although rarely, I would get on the phone and ask wealthy people for money. Our approach for raising funds for a statewide campaign in the small state of Vermont worked well for our needs. Now, however, we were playing in a different league and needed to raise far, far more money. As we contemplated the run for president, several things became clear in terms of fundraising. First, I was not going to do what every other presidential candidate was doing, and that was to establish a super PAC. Super PACs, which allow for unlimited contributions from wealthy people, are the exact manifestation of everything that is wrong with politics today. The idea of establishing one was tempting and easy to do, but I wasn't going to do it. Second, I was not going to spend large amounts of time on the phone begging money from wealthy individuals or organizations. Not only was this time-consuming, it was extraordinarily demoralizing. It would take the spirit right out of what I wanted to do. Third, I was not going to do high-dollar fundraisers where small numbers of people made large contributions. This was going to be a people's campaign, and I was going to spend my time and energy talking to ordinary human beings. To the degree that we did fundraisers, and we did a few, they would be low-dollar events. People were welcome to contribute more, but a $25 donation would be more than enough to get you right in the door. So, how would we raise the kind of money we would need to run a serious national campaign? The answer was pretty simple. We would encourage in every way we could large numbers of people to make small contributions. This would be an essential part of what the political revolution was all about. We would show the world that, yes, it was possible to run a serious national campaign without being dependent on wealthy people, Wall Street, corporate interests, and their super PACs. Consistent with my view that real change never takes place from the top on down, but always from the bottom on up, that's how we would raise our campaign funds. And that is exactly what we did, with a success that we could never have imagined. Through our online efforts, our campaign ended up raising the astronomical sum of $232 million. That money came from some 8 million individual contributions from 2.5 million people. The average donation was $27. This is an unprecedented accomplishment in the history of American politics, and I am enormously grateful to all those who helped make it happen. Chapter 5, The Campaign Begins. May 26, 2015, Burlington, Vermont. Today is the day, the formal announcement, I am running for President of the United States. Jane and I and the few others we had on board had argued as to whether or not we should do the opening campaign event inside or outside, at lunchtime or in the early evening. In my previous campaigns for Congress and the U.S. Senate, we did the events indoors at a large local church. They work well. Hundreds of Vermonters attended. But this was different. We were running for the White House, larger crowd, a lot of media to accommodate, a much bigger deal. Fortunately, Jane prevailed. We decided to do the event outside in the very beautiful waterfront park on Lake Champlain that I had helped to create when I was mayor 30 years before. The park had a wide grassy area that could accommodate, we hoped, a large crowd, and as a backdrop, we had the beautiful Adirondack Mountains behind the lake. We would hold the event after work with the hope that more people would be able to attend, and we prayed for good weather. We didn't have much of a rain plan. We lucked out. It was a perfect Vermont spring day. People started arriving early, and they kept on coming. To our utter amazement, over 5,000 people showed up, men, women, and a lot of kids. The local newspaper live-streamed the event, and 7,000 more people were there in that way. According to the local media, it was the largest political gathering in the modern history of the state. The event attracted a decent amount of national media as well. All of the major networks and cable television stations were there, as well as virtually all of the national newspapers. Ed Schultz of MSNBC broadcast the event live. Needless to say, the event was heavily covered by the Vermont media. In the past, when I had announced my candidacy for office in Vermont, or given any kind of important speech, it was usually an informal affair. I would walk through the crowd, shake hands, and chat. That's the way we are in Vermont. But today was different. Too many people, too much media, too much opportunity for something to go wrong. On this day, I was driven to right behind the stage, and that's where I waited for the introductory remarks to end. It was an emotional day for me, because many of the Vermonters in attendance were people I knew, some for many years. They were friends, neighbors, and people I had worked with in one way or another for decades, as a mayor, congressman, or senator. My entire family, Jane, Levy, and Rainey, Heather and Mark, Karina and Blake, Dave and Liza, and Nicole and Keegan, were up on the stage with me, as well as my 7 grandchildren, Sonny, Cole, Riley, Grayson, Ella, Tess, and Dylan. We were all together, beginning a very strange venture. We had no idea as to how it would end or where it would lead us. But in my beautiful state of Vermont, we were starting off with an enormous amount of love. After great music by my favorite Vermont band, Mango Jam, I was introduced by friends I had worked closely with in Vermont over the years, people who knew me well. Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield of Ben & Jerry's, Donna Bailey of the Addison County Parent-Child Center, Bill McKibben, one of the leading environmentalists in the world, Brenda Torpy, the head of the Champlain Valley Housing Trust, Mike O'Day, a local labor leader, and Jenny Nelson, a Vermont leader on agricultural issues. In his introductory remarks, Ben Cohen was very kind, and this is what he said. Bernie is the real thing. He's not about reading the polls and seeing what he has to say to get elected. The guy's been saying and doing the same stuff for the last 30 years. If it weren't so inspiring, he'd be boring. He's about leading with his heart and his soul and using his brain for what's best for the little guy. Bill McKibben, who lives 40 miles down the road in Ripton, Vermont, said, "What you see is what you get, and nowhere is that more true than his staunch defense of the environment. We need to let this nation know that Bernie is loved in every corner of this great state, in Newport in the north to Bennington and Brattleboro in the south. There is no leader who Vermonters have ever respected and voted for quite the way that they respect Bernie, because they know he always means what he says, and he always stands for what he believes." Then it was my turn, with family and friends at my side, to give the following remarks. Today we begin a political revolution.
Let me thank all of you, not only for being here today, but for the support you have given me over the years as mayor of this beautiful city, as Vermont's only congressman, and now as our United States Senator. I also want to thank my longtime friends and fellow Vermonters, Bill McKibben, Brenda Torpy, Donna Bailey, Mike O'Day, and Ben and Jerry, for all that they do and for their very generous remarks. And thanks also to Jenny Nelson for moderating this event and for her incredible leadership in Vermont agriculture. I also want to thank my family, my wife Jane, my brother Larry, my children Levy, Heather, Karina, and Dave for their love and support, and my beautiful 7 grandchildren, Sonny, Cole, Riley, Grayson, Ella, Tess, and Dylan, who provide so much joy in my life. Today, here in our small state, a state that has led this nation in so many ways, I am proud to announce my candidacy for President of the United States of America. Today, Today, with your support and the support of millions of people throughout our country, we begin a political revolution to transform our country economically, politically, socially, and environmentally. Today, we stand here and say loudly and clearly, enough is enough. This great nation and its government belong to all of the people and not to a handful of billionaires. Brothers and sisters, now is not the time for thinking small. Now is not the time for the same old establishment politics and stale inside the Beltway ideas. Now is the time for millions of working families to come together to revitalize American democracy, to end the collapse of our middle class, and to make certain that our children and grandchildren are able to enjoy a quality of life that brings them health, prosperity, security, and joy, and that once again makes the United States the leader in the world in the fight for economic and social justice, for environmental sanity, and for a world of peace. My fellow Americans, this country faces more serious problems today than at any time since the Great Depression, and if you include the planetary crisis of climate change, it may well be that the challenges we face now are more dire than at any time in the modern history of our country. And here is my promise to you for this campaign. Not only will I fight to protect the working families of this country, but we are going to build a movement of millions of Americans who are prepared to stand up and fight back. We are going to take this campaign directly to the people in town meetings, door-to-door conversations, on street corners, and in social media. This week, we're going to be in New Hampshire, we're going to be in Iowa, and we're going to be in Minnesota, and that is just the start of this national campaign. Let me be clear. This campaign is not about Bernie Sanders, it's not about Hillary Clinton, it is not about Jeb Bush or anyone else. This campaign is about the needs of the American people. And the ideas and proposals that effectively address those needs. As someone who has never run a negative political ad in my life, my campaign will not be driven by political gossip or reckless personal attacks. This is what the American people want and deserve. These are serious times. We need serious debates. Politics in a democratic society should not be treated as if it were a baseball game, a game show, or a soap opera. And I hope the media understands that as well. Let me take a minute to touch on some of the issues that I will be focusing on in the coming months, and then give you a brief outline of an agenda for America an agenda which, in fact, will deal with these serious problems and lead us to a better future. Today we live in a nation which is the wealthiest nation in the history of the world, but that reality means very little for most of us because almost all of that wealth is owned and controlled by a tiny handful of individuals. In America, we now have more income and wealth inequality than any other major country on earth, and the gap between the very rich and everyone else is growing wider and wider. The issue of wealth and income inequality is the great moral issue of our time. It is the great economic issue of our time. It is the great political issue of our time, and we will address it. Let me be very clear, and let the top 1% understand this. There is something profoundly wrong when the top 0.1% owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%, and when 99% of all new income goes to the top 1%. There is something profoundly wrong when in recent years we have seen a proliferation of millionaires and billionaires at the same time as millions of Americans are working longer hours for lower wages, and we have shamefully the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country. There is something profoundly wrong when one family owns more wealth in this country than the bottom 130 million Americans. This grotesque level of inequality is immoral. It is bad economics. It is unsustainable. This type of rigged economy is not what America is supposed to be about. This has got to change. And as your president, together, we are going to change it. But it is not just income and wealth inequality. It is a tragic reality that for the last 40 years, the great middle class of our country, once the envy of the entire world, has been disappearing. Despite exploding technology and increased worker productivity, median family income is almost $5,000 less today than it was in 1999. In our great state and all over this country, people are working not one job, but two jobs, three jobs, trying to cobble together an income and some health care. That is not acceptable. We can and must do better. The truth is that real unemployment is not 5.4%, which you read in the papers. It is close to 11%. Youth unemployment, 17%. African American youth unemployment, off the charts. Today, shamefully, we have 45 million people living in poverty, many of whom are working at low-wage jobs. In America today, despite the gains of the Affordable Care Act, 35 million Americans still lack any health insurance. My friends, that is the reality of the middle class in America today. And that is a reality not just for us, but for our kids and our grandchildren that we are going to change. Yeah. My fellow Americans, let me be as blunt as I can and tell you what you already know. As a result of the disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, the American political system has been totally corrupted, and the foundations of American democracy are now being undermined. What the Supreme Court said, essentially, was that it was not good enough for the billionaires to own much of the economy. They can now own the United States government as well, and that is precisely what they are trying to do. Now, what I learned in school, and I think what the men and women who put their lives on the line to defend our country have long known, that American democracy is not about billionaires being able to buy candidates and buy elections. It is not about the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and other incredibly wealthy individuals spending billions of dollars to elect candidates who will make the rich richer and everyone else poorer. According to media reports, if you can believe it, the Koch brothers in this election cycle are prepared to spend more money than either the Democratic or Republican parties. That is not democracy. That is oligarchy. In Vermont, at our town meetings, we know what democracy is about. That is one person, one vote. And that's the kind of political system we are going to fight for and are going to achieve. Now, when we talk about our responsibilities as human beings and as parents, there is nothing more important than leaving this country and the entire planet in a way that is habitable for our kids and our grandchildren. The debate is over. The scientific community has spoken in a virtually unanimous voice. Climate change is real, it is caused by human activity, and it is already causing devastating problems in our country and around the world. And let's be clear, if we do not get our act together and have the United States lead the world in combating climate change, there will be more drought, more famine, more rising sea level, more floods, more ocean acidification, more extreme weather disturbances. As human beings who look out over this environment, who appreciate the beauty that we have on this planet, we are not going to allow the fossil fuel industry to destroy this planet. Brothers and sisters, it is no secret that there is massive discontent with politics in America today. In the last midterm election, some 63% of Americans did not vote, including 80% of young people. Poll after poll tells us that our citizens no longer have confidence in our political institutions and given the power of big money in the political process in general. They understand that their pain is not being heard in Washington, and that people in Washington and elected officials are much more concerned about the lobbyists and the billionaires than the suffering of ordinary people. Now, combating this political alienation, this cynicism, and this legitimate anger will not be easy. That's for sure. But that is exactly what, together, we must do if we're going to turn this country around, and that is what this campaign is all about. And if we are going to bring people together, we need a simple, straightforward, progressive agenda which speaks to the needs of the American people and provides us with a vision of a very different America. And what is that agenda? Let me briefly tell you what I think. The agenda begins with jobs, jobs, and more jobs. If we are serious about reversing the decline of the middle class, we need a major federal jobs program which puts millions of people back to work at good-paying jobs. At a time when our roads, our bridges, our water systems, rail, and airports are decaying, the most effective way to rapidly create meaningful jobs is to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. And that is why I've introduced legislation which would invest $1 trillion over 5 years to modernize our country's physical infrastructure, legislation that would create and maintain 13 million good-paying jobs. And as your president, I will lead the effort to make sure that legislation is passed. I will also continue to oppose our current trade policies. For decades, presidents from both parties have supported trade agreements which have cost us millions of decent-paying jobs as corporate America shuts down plants in Vermont and throughout this country and moves to low-wage countries. As president, my trade policies will break that cycle of agreements which enrich the few at the expense of the many. Let us also be honest and acknowledge that today millions of American workers are now working for totally inadequate wages. The current federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour is a starvation wage and must be raised. The minimum wage in this country must become a living wage, which means raising it to $15 an hour over the next few years. Our goal, and this is not a radical idea, but our goal must be that any worker in this country who works 40 hours a week is not living in poverty. Further, we must establish pay equity for women workers. It is unconscionable that women earn 78 cents on the dollar compared to men who perform the same work. We must also revise our overtime standards so that people making 25 or 30,000 an hour, 30,000 a year, who are working 50, 60 hours a week, get time and a half. And we need paid sick leave and guaranteed vacation time for every worker in this country. This campaign, starting today, is going to send a message to the billionaire class. And that is, you can't have it all. You can't get huge tax breaks while children in this country go hungry. You can't continue sending our jobs abroad while millions are looking for work. You can't hide your profits in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens while there are massive unmet needs on every corner of this nation. to the billionaire class, I say that your greed has got to end. You cannot take advantage of all of the benefits of America if you refuse to accept your responsibilities. And that is why we need a tax system which is fair and progressive, which tells the wealthiest individuals and the largest corporations that they are going to begin to start paying their fair share of taxes. When we talk about power, we talk about Wall Street. In my view, it is time to break up the largest financial institutions in this country. Wall Street cannot continue to be an island unto itself, gambling trillions in risky financial instruments while expecting the public to bail it out. If a bank is too big to fail, that bank is too big to exist. If we are serious about a progressive agenda that speaks to the needs of working families, that talks about climate change and the needs of our kids and the elderly, we must be focused on campaign finance reform and the need for a constitutional amendment to overturn this disastrous Citizens United decision. I have said it before and I'll say it again. I will not nominate any justice to the Supreme Court who has not made it clear that he or she will move to overturn that disastrous decision which is undermining American democracy. Longer term, we need to go further and establish public funding of elections. As I look to our future, it is clear to me that the United States of America must lead the world in reversing climate change. We can do that by transforming our energy system away from fossil fuels toward energy efficiency and such sustainable energies as wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass. Brothers and sisters, the United States of America today remains the only major country on earth that does not guarantee health care to all people as a right. Despite the modest gains of the Affordable Care Act, 35 million Americans continue to have no health insurance, and even more are underinsured. Yet, despite that pathetic record, we end up spending almost twice as much per capita on health care as any other nation. In my strong opinion, the United States must join the rest of the industrialized world and guarantee health care to all as a right. And we must do it through a Medicare for All single-payer program. At a time when millions of Americans are struggling to keep their heads above water economically, at a time when senior poverty is increasing, at a time when millions of kids in this country don't get enough food to eat, my Republican colleagues, as part of their recently passed budget, are trying to make a terrible situation even worse. If you can believe it, and this is the truth, the Republican budget throws 27 million Americans off of health insurance, makes drastic cuts in Medicare, throws millions of low-income Americans including pregnant women, off of nutrition programs and makes it harder, and makes it harder for working class families to afford college or put their kids in the Head Start program. And then to add insult to injury, the Republican budget provides huge tax breaks for the very richest people in this country while they raise taxes on working families. Well, let me tell my Republican colleagues that I respectfully disagree with their approach. Instead of cutting Social Security, we are going to expand Social Security benefits. Instead of cutting Head Start and child care, we are going to move to a universal pre-K system for all the children of this country. As Franklin Delano Roosevelt reminded us, a nation's greatness is judged not by what it provides to the most well-off, but how it treats the people most in need. And that is the kind of country we must become. And when we talk about education, let me make it very clear. In a highly competitive global economy, we need the best educated workforce we can create. It is insane, it is counterproductive to the best interest of our country that hundreds of thousands of bright young people cannot afford to go to college and that millions of others leave school with a mountain of debt that burdens them for decades. This is not what a great country is about. That must end, and that is why I, as president, will fight to make tuition in public colleges and universities free. As well as substantially lower interest rates on student loans. The young people of our country are the future. They've got to get the education they need. As everybody knows, we live in a difficult and dangerous world. And there are people out there who would do us harm. As president, I will defend this nation, but I will do it responsibly. As a member of Congress, I voted against the war in Iraq, and that was the right vote. I am vigorously opposed to an endless, perpetual war in the Middle East. Yes, we must be vigorous in combating terrorism and defeating ISIS, but we as a nation should not have to bear that burden alone. We must be part of an international coalition led by the Muslim nations that can not only defeat ISIS, but begin the process of creating conditions for lasting peace. As some of you know, I was born in a faraway land called Brooklyn, New York. My father came to this country from Poland without a penny in his pocket and having dropped out of school at a young age. My mother graduated high school in New York City. My father worked his entire life as a paint salesman, never made much money. My parents and my brother and I lived in a small rent-controlled apartment. My mother's dream was to move out of that small 3.5-room apartment and get a home of her own. She died young, and her dream was never fulfilled. As a kid, I learned in many, many ways every day in my house what lack of money means to a family, and that is a lesson that I have never forgotten and never will forget. I have seen, as many of you have, the promise of America in our own lives. My parents never would have dreamed that their son could become a United States Senator, let alone run for president. But for too many of our fellow Americans, the dream of progress and opportunity is being denied by the grind of an economy that funnels virtually all of the wealth and all of the income to the top. And to those who say we cannot restore the dream, I say just look where we are standing today. As some of you will remember, this beautiful place was once an unsightly rail yard that served no public purpose and was an eyesore. As mayor, I worked with the people of Burlington to help turn this waterfront into the beautiful people-oriented public space it is today. We took that fight to the courts, to the legislature, and to the people, and we won. The lesson to be learned, and it is a profound political lesson, is that when people stand together, when people are prepared to fight back, there is nothing that cannot be accomplished. We can live in a country where every person has health care is a right, not a privilege. We can live in a country where every parent can have quality and affordable child care, and where all of our qualified young people can get a college education regardless of their income. We can live in a country where every senior can live in dignity and security and not be forced to choose between food and medicine. We can live in a country where every veteran who has put his or her life on the line to defend this nation gets the quality health care and benefits they have earned and deserve. We can live in a country where every person, no matter their race, their religion, their disability, or their sexual orientation, realizes the full promise of equality that is our birthright as Americans. Brothers and sisters, that is the nation we can build together. And I ask you and people throughout this country to join us in this campaign to build a future that works for all of us and not just the few people on top. Thank you again for coming out on this beautiful day. Thank you.
Chapter 6, On the Campaign Trail. The kickoff event in Burlington was a great success, and we were off and running. The turnout of some 5,000 supporters was far more than we had ever expected, and the love and enthusiasm I received from my fellow Vermonters was deeply moving to me. It was a day I will never forget. During the early stages of the campaign, I was often asked by the media, "Do you really think you could win the nomination? Can you really beat Hillary Clinton?" My response was always the same. Yes, I was running to win. I thought we could win. But in my heart of hearts, I knew how difficult this challenge would be. What we were trying to do was unprecedented in modern American history. We were not just running an insurgent campaign as an underdog. We were taking aim at the nation's entire political and financial establishment. And we were running against the most powerful political machine in the country. Let's not forget, the Clinton political organization had won two presidential campaigns for Bill Clinton, and they had run a strong race for Hillary in 2008. They were closely connected with thousands of Democratic Party leaders at the national, state, and local levels, many of whom had worked for Bill as president or Hillary as Secretary of State. The Clintons had by far the most powerful fundraising system in the Democratic Party. They had created their own very good think tank, the Center for American Progress, and a huge international organization, the Clinton Foundation. They had vast contacts in the corporate world, the financial world, and the foreign policy world. The conventional wisdom inside the Beltway and among the talking heads on TV was that Clinton was the anointed candidate, the inevitable candidate. The primary and caucus process was just a matter of going through the motions until she was officially nominated at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia in late July 2016. CNN more or less captured the position we were in on their website on May 28, 2015. This is what they wrote. The obstacles Sanders faces in the presidential primary race, however, are immense. Sanders has no viable countrywide political organization, so he must foment a grassroots uprising. His task is complicated by the fact that although he caucuses with the Democrats in the Senate, he has always been a